Altered states, shamanism, ceremonial magic, yoga, and the joy of psychonautics. Throughout human history, our instinctual drive for spiritual truth has often driven members of our species to the painful edge of rational knowledge and sensation. We have always been compelled to directly discover and face that great force which lifts the sun out of the darkness every morning. The record of our spiritual yearnings is as old as the record of human civilization. Man, as Aleister Crowley said, is a spiritual animal. Since as far back as we can tell, there have always been those who have journeyed to the pale of known things and found that netherworld wherein an interconnectedness with all things and the transcendent vision of the Godhead within can be experienced. We have chanted, drummed, prayed, flagellated, spun, smoked, tripped, fasted, meditated, and pounded ourselves throughout our known existence at all places for just one shred of light to make its way into the mundanity of our everyday lives. We have always sought altered states of consciousness, self-induced or not, drug-inspired or not, in order to get to that place where we might encounter the truly sacred, where we might encounter what the Hebrews call kadosh, the awful otherness of God. In our modern, scientistic, technocratic paradigm, long steeped in Protestantism and capitalism, the pursuit of altered states of consciousness in order to achieve spiritual union or rapture is generally frowned upon. There is a long-standing taboo against ingesting naturally occurring psychoactive substances, which, I believe, stems from the history of, quote, civilized people trying to distance themselves from the, quote, uncivilized of the world. Smoking a pipe or ingesting an entheogenic mushroom, especially for religious or spiritual reasons, smacks of primitivism. There is no place for that in the synagogue, the mosque, the church, any more than in the state house, the capitol, and the classroom. However, the objective sought in fasting, holding all-night vigils as the fathers of Eastern Orthodoxy and Islam did, in praying in a desert for 40 days, prolonged chanting and drumming is all the same, that of the elevation or temporary disintegration of the conscious, logical, or ego mind. Why attempt this? Because, as is phenomenologically available to every person, when we push ourselves to the fringe of normal consciousness, and maybe past that frontier, a vast and terrifying, awe-inspiring world is experienced in a so real way. The dream state is similar, but its chaotic and generally baffled nature is due to its lack of conscious intention, most of the time. Experiencing a state of non-regular consciousness deliberately brought upon oneself with a stated purpose is far more powerful than normal dreaming, although dreaming can obviously be, just like every second of one's life, an incredibly powerful place to do spiritual work. The endeavor of this piece is to explore the use of altered states of consciousness in many of their various forms for psychological healing and spiritual work, what we have always called initiation or salvation in some form. I want to also explore the office or role of shaman in indigenous cultures such as the Amazon basin or the highlands of Siberia, and then in a modern context, to try to see if the responsibilities and journey of the shaman might be realizable within our modern, exhausted paradox. I will try to present a few simple ideas about how this could manifest in our cities and suburbs, and our bedrooms, at the supermarket, at the nightly serving gig. It is my knowledge that, underneath or in between everything, quote, all existence is pure joy, that all the sorrows are but as shadows, they pass and are done, but there is that which remains, end quote. It is that which remains which we want to extricate or rescue from the passing shadows and phantoms of this earthly kingdom. Once the other world is glimpsed, once its breeze is felt on one's skin, and once one sees how much more real it is very difficult to ignore and not long to return to. It is an alchemical pursuit, to free spirit from the loathsome lust and cold confines of matter. And it appears that the shaman, in addition to the Western magician, Eastern yogi, or any other brand of mystic, happens to be somewhat of a professional in this field of mind surfing or psychonautics. In The Invisible Landscape, Dennis and Terence McKenna write that, quote, the vocation of shaman is found in nearly all archaic cultures, from Australian Aborigines to the Jivaro Indians of central Ecuador and Peru to the Yakut tribes of Siberia, end quote. A certain kind of power is held by the shaman, a power seldom understood to us moderns. He is able to access planes of awareness, levels of consciousness, and other dimensions than the rest of the tribe. He is able to see the spirits of the dead, or those that have wandered off from their bodies as in coma or possession. He is sought by the members of the tribe as a source of wisdom beyond their scope, and often to divine the future or the inner unseen turmoil and diseases of individuals. It is this power which demands of a shaman. He must be a, quote, sick man who has been healed, one who has seen the other side, or born again. According to anthropologist Michael Horner, the, quote, main defining characteristic of a shaman is that he or she is someone who enters an altered state of consciousness, usually induced by monotonous drumming or other percussion sound, in order to make journeys for a variety of purposes in what are technically called the lower and upper worlds, to interact consciously with certain guardian powers or spirits there. End quote. The shaman is usually a character on the outskirts of the village, as well as his society or culture. He is a silent presence, yet more powerful than chief or king, wielding a power which all must obey. Often a shaman has some sort of predisposition to mania and or trance states, an almost antisocial focus on the unseen. He sometimes undergoes a serious sickness or horrific accident, barely escaping death, and after beating the scythe is thought to be imbued with supernatural powers or insight. A future shaman might be born deformed or with some sort of taxing physical issue, which might set him apart to the tribe as special or different, much like the village idiot, fool, or jester of the European Middle Ages. The shaman's overarching purpose and field of influence include nothing less than the spiritual evolution of his tribe. He has made himself identityless, an empty vessel which has become a conduit for the, quote, crazy wisdom of the other world, the spirits, or the collective unconscious. As one heretic explained, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. The shaman is a psychopomp who maintains the spiritual equilibrium of his people through ritual, healings, divination, and prophecy, using altered states of consciousness to bring what we call divine wisdom down into three-dimensional space-time. The infinite varieties of the role of the shaman in the world's cultures, from the Tamang of Nepal, the Lakota Sioux, to the Ayahuasqueros of the Amazon Basin, reflect each other in many remarkable ways, from the minutiae of ritual elements to methods of entering and maintaining trance states to their place and function in society and so on. These subjects can be explored in many interesting books. The best of all, even though dated in its outlook, might be The Golden Bough by James Frazier. However, our purpose is to explore the dynamics of the shaman's use of altered states of consciousness in order to achieve certain ends in this consciousness. First things first, we need to try to define consciousness. Consciousness basically is thought. It is made of thought, the chitta or mind stuff of the Hindus, or pure information. Each of us, through our nervous systems, and really at base in our DNA, have access to a particular band of the spectrum. One can think of the spectrum itself as God or the source for now. Our species naturally has evolved and is always evolving to be availed of a particular channel or frequency in that spectrum, much as the color yellow is a particular frequency of the electromagnetic spectrum. Each of us, due to biological and neurological constitution, with some variance but not much, participate in a kind of consensus reality, or realization of consciousness, which is basically homogeneous. We call this ordinary waking reality. This waking reality can be seen to have a huge variety of influences, from eating a gigantic meal to falling in love, or climbing a 14,000-foot peak, or losing a loved one. It can also be tampered with mechanically, chemically. A certain amount of alcohol can bring exalted inspiration and artistic genius. That of marijuana allows for increased sensory receptivity and a certain lightness, the ability to derive creative images and ideas, motifs and systems from experience with delightful ease. A dash of cocaine can send one's internal chariots into the flames of adventurism, scrambling up trees and through books and ideas with an unquenchable zeal. 5 to 10 hits of LSD seemingly allows your nervous system to reach out and actually touch the world and be at one with it, and to be presented with incredibly beautiful, incredibly present and real visions like multicolored matrices of light and impossible patterns and sounds, the ability to be made aware of all of one's true faults and blocks, as well as one's true strengths and purpose. There are countless others. The extensively documented use of psychotropic or entheogenic substances amongst shamans, as well as the history of this phenomenon, are the focus of several classic books. Among them are Robert Graves' Food for Centaurs, Gordon Wasson's Soma, Divine Mushroom of Immortality, Mircea Eliade's Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, and Dennis and Terence McKenna's The Invisible Landscape. There is ample evidence that, for instance, the inspiration for the Vedic civilization in Hinduism was the Amanita muscaria mushroom, spoken of as Soma by the Rig Veda. Speaking of this collection of second millennia Indian scripture, Wasson states that, quote, the whole corpus of hymns, and the Avesta as well, must be reread in light of the discovery that a divine mushroom was in the center of these religions, was the focus of these poets, end quote. The use of ayahuasca and psilocybin by Amazon Basin and other indigenous American shamans is, quote, widespread and occurs in every region of the globe where the plants occur, end quote. Amongst the ancient Hebrews, the priests were known to wear elaborate hats, which closely resembled the Amanita muscaria. The record of the use of these substances, from the ingestion of ergot, the fungus being the chief ingredient of LSD, 2,000 years ago on the sixth day at the Mystery Schools of Ulysses, to the peyote sacrament of the Native American Church, is a rich and intriguing account. It would behoove us to explore these frontiers. For now, we will move on to the main objection of this paper, which is to explore altered states, specifically in their efficacy towards spiritual wisdom or gnosis. Much negative attention is paid to the supposedly daring or dangerous use of psychedelic or entheogenic drugs in modern culture, in what could be broadly called alternative culture or spirituality. However, as aforementioned, there have always existed groups, from primitive to highly civilized, who used these substances in order to attain to certain states. The altered states were a means to an end, and that end is, in short, to do spiritual work in rarer dimensions of consciousness. This work has been highly developed and brought into extremely complex scientific structure by many cultures in history, such as Raja Yoga in Hinduism, ceremonial magic in Europe, and, as we have already mentioned, with shamanism. We know that there are three basic brain states, or frequencies, beta, alpha, and delta. These are electromagnetic wave frequencies which can be mapped by an electroencephalograph, or EEG. The beta state is normal waking consciousness, the one we drive around, go to school, and wake up in. Its frequency is anywhere above 12 hertz per second. The alpha state represents the state usually associated with daydreaming, sleep dreaming, trance states, and so on. It is characterized by high activity in the visual cortex during an idle state. Its frequency is between 8 and 12 hertz per second. The third state, delta, consists of frequencies under 3 hertz, and it's present in stages 3 and 4 of deep sleep, dreamless sleep, and non-REM sleep. Now, this is a very, very basic roundup of the brain state question. But it appears that the middle state, alpha, generally is particularly conducive to doing work of an imaginative, creative, or spiritual nature. There is a certain power in this state. The mind creates what it wants. Reality seems to bend into strange and impossible forms, and we come face to face with the images and emotions arising from the unconscious. One can attain to this state anytime one wishes to. Common means are prolonged chanting, drumming, or any kind of rote activity which one can lose oneself in. I used to mow lawns every week and could easily get into this state when I was doing that. The body still operating properly and with precision, the mind in a fantastic netherworld. There is ample evidence that certain ascetic practices such as fasting and abstaining from sleep or standing on one leg for a long time bring about the alpha state as well. The recent interest in lucid dreaming, one of the more popular in the New Age bazaar of ideas erupting into mainstream consciousness these days, necessitates this brain state. By simply using one's own imagination and through consistent practice and prolonged concentration and holding thought forms in the mind, it is possible to place oneself in a psychodrama, which can be guided or not, and can turn into a gate through which one can pass through the doors of imagination and into a truly different world. A world obviously and apparently not merely of one's own imagination. Carl Jung referred to this as active imagination and insisted upon its importance in working with the psyche. Having introduced my ideas of the nature of consciousness and the simple mechanics and potentialities of the brain using the alpha state, to say nothing of drugs, as well as a note on shamanism and the function of the shaman in society, I wish to speak briefly of two spiritual traditions which correspond interestingly to shamanism. The focus on altered states continues. Ceremonial magic could be called the yoga or shamanism of the West. It developed into a high peak during the 17th century in Western Europe, with an obvious and considerable widespread rise of Rosicrucianism, reinterest in alchemy, and in the dealings with angels, demons, and other praeterhuman entities. It undoubtedly had a characteristically Christian flavor. Many of the adepts of this tradition, from Cornelius Agrippa to Eliphas Levi, Charles Stansfield Jones, Dion Fortune, considered themselves first and foremost to be Christians, and secondarily magicians. Even, quote, the wickedest man in the world, the great beast 666, known as Aleister Crowley, quotes the Bible in his mammoth corpus of writings with more authority, understanding, passion, and frequency than any occult or even secular authority that I have read. The object of ceremonial magic, much like shamanism and yoga, is to seek and acquire knowledge, wisdom, or gnosis from these other planes, entities, or brain states. And the alpha state is necessary for doing it. More than any ritual, tool, or means of invocation, this state of mind, or altered state, is the linchpin of doing magical work. In his Magic and Theory and Practice, Crowley wrote that, quote, the whole secret may be summarized in these four words, inflame thyself in praying. The mind must be exalted until it loses consciousness of self. The magician must be carried blindly by a force which, though in him and of him, is by no means that which he in his normal state of consciousness calls I. Just as the poet, the lover, the artist is carried out of himself in a creative frenzy, so must it be for the magician. Ceremonial magic is cultivating within oneself this state and performing meditative practices and psychodramatic rituals, much in the same way that a Catholic priest performs rituals for his congregation. Instead of relying upon the supposed saintliness or divine inspiration of a priest, though, the magician initiates within himself the journey to the pale of normal consciousness, in order to increasingly know himself, to heal himself, and to know more about the universe around and within him. This is why witches, magicians, alchemists, seers, and mystics have been so persecuted throughout history. They provide an example which, if caught on to by a critical mass of the society, might ensure the dissolution of that culture's need for an organized, dogmatized religion, and most importantly, its attendant priest classes. The great psychotherapist and occultist Israel Regardi provided the following explanation of magic in his The Middle Pillar. Quote, every technique of magic is intended in various ways to widen the field of vision of the conscious ego to the deeper, more spiritual aspects of the divine nature, which in reality is his true or higher self. Enabling man to become an engine capable of harnessing and directing the enormous power that lies within. A multitude of basic principles are utilized to this end. Adoration, which is essential to attaining a sense of unity with Godhead, concentration, development of will and use of it to accomplish a given purpose, achievement of self-awareness, and the ability to breathe properly are the outcome of even basic magical practices. End quote. The means by which one, when practicing formal ceremonial magic, might attain to a desired altered state is through the manipulations of his surroundings. He creates of his sacred space an almost laboratory-like environment, wherein every aspect of the space is aimed towards the evocation of certain feelings and mental states. For instance, if one were to desire a better understanding of communication and speaking, of finding and nurturing one's own inner voice and allowing that voice to be heard as it should be, or perhaps of mediating conflicts and understanding the dynamics of interpersonal communication, one might consider the following. There are God forms, God names, incenses, stones, colors, numbers, planets, symbols, shapes, metals, drugs, scriptures, and the like, which correspond with the addressing of such problems. Mercury, Hermes, Hanuman, Odin, and Thoth relate to communication and speaking in some way. According to the Table of Correspondences, Crowley, the correspondent stone is opal, the plant moly, the perfume storax, the color orange, etc. Using these details, the magician would affect his ritual space accordingly, the idea being that all of these effects, and the more and dramatic the better, will have an impact on his unconscious which will bring about the desired change in the psychological constitution. Evocation is the process of bringing a piece or complex of one's mind out into the open, perhaps even materializing in incense smoke or as blue light hovering in front of one. The idea is nothing different than performing surgery on the psyche. There is an unhealthy trait, memory, or hateful grudge of some kind which one wants to get rid of, and so one uses magic to evoke the quote-unquote demon in order to fully see it for what it is and finally banish it for good. Of course, chanting, drumming, circumambulation, and the like have their place in ceremonial magic as well, and are quite common means of bringing about an altered state, especially when working with a group. Magic is a system of applied psychotherapy and can be done individually or with a group of people. All the ritual elements listed above are a means of bringing about an altered state of consciousness wherein the block between conscious and unconscious mind is temporarily removed, much as is necessary in hypnosis or psychotherapy. We can see even from this terribly brief perusal of the subject that ceremonial magic is very similar to shamanism. In both, the practitioner must enter into an exalted state, inflamed or altered, in order to seek and gain conversation of the disparate intelligences existed in his psyche or in the universe at large. These practices cannot be accomplished without entering into this altered state. All the tools, weapons, paraphernalia, utterances, and details are secondary to the swoon. Another science of psychonautics, which developed in a very different part of the world from ceremonial magic, issuing from a very different kind of culture, is that of yoga. Meaning in Sanskrit, to yoke or bring into union, yoga is an art and science which was first admitted to paper and set down into concrete structure by as early as the 8th century AD in the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali. And as many different schools or branches, all of them being the freeing of the spirit and man from the chokehold of body and matter. In its most available and popular form in the West, yoga is most likely thought of as a series of bodily exercises consisting of holding oneself in cantankerous pretzel-like positions for extended periods of time. That is a school of yoga, the most basic, called Hatha Yoga, which consists of stretching the muscles, massaging the organs, and gaining physical strength, flexibility, and health. Hatha yoga also consists of learning to breathe, sleep, sit, stand, and eat properly in a way which fosters and maximizes the health, awareness, and efficiency of the body. However, there are many branches of yoga. Of the ones higher on the metaphysical tree, the most rarely sought and most potentially rewarding would be Raja yoga. Raja yoga consists mainly in working with the mind to attain states of consciousness whereby one becomes aware of the true nature of his mind and, importantly, how to stand behind the mind and witness its leaps and bounds, its weaknesses and potential. The Raja yogi trains his mind through concentration, meditation, withdrawal from the objects of sensory perception, etc., in order to push his mind out of its imposing restrictions, allowing it to expand out from the brain, as it were. Swami Vivekananda, the great patron saint of yoga who delivered so many talks and wrote so many books to a Western audience at the time when World War I was ravaging the Western Hemisphere, speaking of the aim of Raja Yoga while perhaps unknowingly addressing the shaman as well in a particular statement in his Raja Yoga, said that, quote, "The aim of all training should be to make the man grow. The man who influences, who throws his magic, as it were, upon his fellow beings is a dynamo of power, and when that man is ready, he can do anything and everything he likes." End quote. This is exemplified by Christ's retreat to the desert to meditate for 40 days. It is this type of mental training which, in the case of Raja Yoga, reaches a highly scientific form. Keeping in mind all we have covered, I think we can come up with some idea of how to seek and converse with one's own shaman self, if you will. It is obvious that there is a particular brain state which allows one to use one's own imagination towards a lot of different ends. But our purpose is to understand how these states allow us to affect change in our lives. It's all very simple. The experiences which occur as a result are gigantic. Let's say there is an aspect of ourselves we wish to heal, a wound that was caused long ago and we haven't the courage to face it, to go back into that space. Often, shitty things have happened to us, even if we don't think about them consciously very often, and they can have disastrous effects on our lives. Whether it was early childhood or a year ago, we all accumulate baggage, which proves to be quite heavy after some time. We've all heard about venting and letting off some steam, either through playing football, the drums, shooting off a gun in the desert, punching a wall, or boring one's coworkers to tears. This is healthy, but it doesn't do anything to get rid of the simmering pot or the water. one has to get at the root, like with a weed. A way of getting to the root is to first of all find a space where one can be undisturbed for a little while and arrange it any way one likes. It should be a temporary representation of your inner temple, if you will. Sit down, lie down, stand, it doesn't really matter. Just be comfortable and aware. Close your eyes and let your head soar for a while. Observe the flow of thoughts as you would observe a river from the bank. Then start to rein in the jumping monkeys, as it were, and focus the mind. It could be on a mental image, shape, idea, word, it doesn't matter. Just try to get all of yourself focused on one thing and keep doing it for a little while. Then you can slowly enter into the imaginary mental space you decided upon beforehand as correct for confronting this person or issue face to face. A statement of intent for doing the meditation before starting is very important. Just as a scientist wouldn't just wander into a lab and start carelessly and indiscriminately playing around with the equipment, we shouldn't either when entering deep mental spaces. Anyhow, once one is sufficiently in a trance-like state, lucid, is when to initiate the confrontation with the inner dirt one is trying to bring to up into some light and face it and digest it finally. The nuances of the way that a meditation like this might be set up and executed are legion. That's up to the individual. I'm just trying to explain the general mechanisms involved as I understand them. Other means of initiating the closer connection to mind and matter is to go into this state and, again, if one is sufficiently daydreaming and lucid, then just ask out loud or inwardly to see what is inside of you, what voices and roles exist in there, the collection of which you think to be a singular entity, I. You can ask this state questions. Personally, I find myself in a state where I'm not in a forest or a room necessarily, but in a more or less deep space feeling weightless hallucination chamber, best as I can describe it. In this state, I can ask questions, and images fly up to me which seem to relay, later on in a normal state, wisdom on the question. There are elaborate DVD, CD, CD-ROM software, virtual reality, and probably video games to do this stuff with, and you can buy them. But it's pretty simple to explore yourself. Hell, when I was a little boy, when I was going to sleep, I would imagine that I was looking down at myself from the ceiling. I would fill in every detail as it would appear from that perspective. After a short time keeping to this, the imagination would become dream, and there I was, floating at the ceiling, bumping into the walls. The size of this work provides merely a theoretical skeleton at best of the use of altered states by shamanisms and other mystics. It is really just a jumping board into the subject, and there are an infinite amount of resources on it. The important thing to always keep in mind when exploring these realities is to be able to keep one's feet on terra firma, as Dion Fortune said, and not to confuse the planes, as Crowley said. Whether one ingests 5 dried grams of psilocybin mushrooms, or one is simply exploring imaginative mind worlds on the bedroom floor, one must keep one's wits and ultimately one's sense of humor about oneself. I've seen a lot of very serious 19-year-old wannabe gurus in my time, and there's nothing more embarrassing than that.